Yesterday I talked in my Dharma talk for the retreat folks about negative, reactive, and incapacitating doubt and how to deal with that. And then they all, after I talked about that, they all wanted to leave. as if they weren't having enough problems. But today I'm going to talk about questioning doubt that can inspire our action and our impulse to go deep and really be in our lives rather than standing on the edge. So questioning doubt, deep investigation, not so much with our thinking, not dissing our thinking, but deep looking at, curiouser and curiouser, said Alice, curiouser and curiouser, overcoming complacency and loosening our preconceived ideas by doubting them, by looking at them and doubting at them and seeing what they're made up of. So our doubting mind pulls us back from what the moment is offering, so we can weigh pros and cons. So there's a very good side to the doubting mind. We need to weigh pros and cons. Life is short. We need to weigh them. So when I was young, I had what I now consider, at the time I just thought it was confused doubt. But often confused doubt is healthy doubt, because we're sort of weighing in our psyche what path we want to be on, what we want to do in our lives. So for me, many years ago, I decided that I really wanted to practice meditation. And I wanted to basically make that the foundation of my life. But I couldn't decide where to practice. And I moved between the Japanese Zen Center in San Francisco and the Vedanta Center in San Francisco. And I was doubting. But I was doubting in a healthy way. I was noticing, what I liked about each and what I didn't like about each. And I thought, oh, this confused doubt will never end. But it ended, and I've been doing Zen for all these years. But first I had to really, really go inside, really check out what resonated with me. And any decision we make, there are pros and cons. So there were cons for me of doing the Japanese Zen, because it seemed so conformist to me. Everybody had to do everything the same. Everybody had to look the same. Everybody had to dress the same. I knew Japanese culture was like that, but I was American. So I would doubt that. But then I went to the Vedanta Center, and the Vedanta Center, you had to be, if you wanted to go all the way through to this enlightened life that's right here, you had to be celibate. Well, I had a girlfriend. And not only that, I had a live-in girlfriend. And we were sexually active. So that put the kibosh on that one. Also, I began to notice how the teacher at the Zen Center was available to us. Shinryu Suzuki, my root teacher, he was available just in an ordinary way. Whereas in the Vedanta, the teacher was up there, kind of, and you never really got to know him. He was sort of on a pedestal. And it really helped me to have a mentor. So then finally, I gravitated to the Zen Center, which is mostly what I've been doing in the last, more than 50 years. So, for our spiritual practice, we need to practice in a context where we get the most support in going deep into our psyche to discover the well of stillness, the well of timelessness that's right here. Always right here. Always right here. The water of contentment that comes up. It just comes up. But and sooner or later we have to commit ourselves to one practice or another. Sooner or later. Because if you just keep drilling wells here, there, or the other where, you're not going deep. You have to do one so that you can go deep and discover this wellspring of calmness and peace that's at the center of being. So in the retreat yesterday, I talked to folks about taking an acting class, which was about 7 or 8 weeks long. And the acting teacher at the beginning said, "Well, you probably have doubts about what I'm going to be doing because I'm going to have you doing odd things, this being an acting class and all. But can you suspend those doubts just for the next 7 weeks and so that you can really do the acting, so that you can really learn what I have to teach you? Then at the end, you can throw it all out if you want." So people are doing practice period here, which is just that long, just 7, 8 weeks long. And they fill out a commitment sheet, and they commit themselves to do this practice. And then at the end, they can evaluate. They could just decide to tear the whole thing up, or they could say, "Oh, yes, I want to continue in this. I want to continue in this." So one side of my family is Celtic and Irish Catholic. And that's my mother, Mary Margaret's side. Mary Margaret's side. So my mother was raised Irish Catholic. And she started doubting her faith in God, and especially as it was presented in the Catholic Church, when she was in high school. And then when every time she had to go to confession and confess her sins and do Hail Marys, she doubted even more that was really helpful to her, that was really helpful to others. It seemed so punitive to her, and she became intra-punitive. But she doubted that in high school. Well, then she didn't talk to people about it because, you know, that was her whole family. That was her whole life. And then in college, she had a distance from that. There were people there who weren't Catholic. Oh, they weren't Catholic. Oh. And she left the Catholic Church at some point. It was much healthier for her. Her doubt had, no, I'm not dissing the Catholic Church. I'm just talking about my mother's experience of the Catholic Church. Catholic Church can be wonderful. That was her experience. It was much more healthy for her to let go of what she felt were the restrictions laid on her and her own sinfulness as it was presented to her. So that was healthy. Because of her doubt, she became more authentically herself. So doubt can be your ally. It can be your ally. It can let you know there's uncertainty. You can weigh your choices. Prepare for things. Notice things that aren't going well and be prepared. Sometimes your doubting is suggesting you should change your course. Whatever it is, that's what your doubting is doing. Oh. And sometimes your doubt is your conscience coming up. Your conscience. So, as most of you have been doing, I've been following, didn't really want to follow it, but I've been following the Harvey Weinstein stuff, right? And I happened to read, a vignette, actually a whole little article by a woman who had not been propositioned by Harvey, and not even known that he was doing this, but she just felt yucky when she was around him. She doubted, even though he was giving her these contracts and she was going to, you know, make a lot of money. She had some doubt. And because of her doubt, she felt something was wrong, and she left. Oh, so when we have a doubt like that, it's usually telling us something. Telling us something. We can trust our intuition. Don't you think we can trust our intuition? Now, if it were just in our heads, not so much. But through meditation practice, we could get in touch with our intuitive side. And of course, even then, sometimes we'll make mistakes. That's okay. Our doubting will be made up. And then we'll say, oh, I just made that up. And it's good to adopt people in authority who just kind of make promises to you. If I make any promises to you, be careful. Or who do stuff to you or tell you should be a certain way. That's healthy. That's healthy doubt, don't you think? That's healthy. And of course, lots of times we fall into doubt denial because we don't want to pay the price of giving up something. My mother said she was in doubt denial for 3 years because this was her whole community, the Irish Catholics. Nobody left. Nobody left in this small town of Hollister. Nobody left. So she was in denial. But finally she met my father, who was an atheist, actually. And that helped her get out of her denial really fast, right? So skeptical doubt is healthy in our practice. In spiritual and psychological exploration, it's healthy. Just like in science. We're doing something. We doubt, but we're doing something. We're being a lamp unto ourselves, as Buddha said. We're doing an experiment here. We don't know what the results will be, but we have enough faith to continue the experiment. So it's healthy to have indecision due to doubt sometimes, not always. And if it goes on too long, you'll be continually just zipping from one thing to another, and you'll never go deep in your lives, in your psyche. So in Zen, particularly in Rinzai Zen, but in Soto Zen too, doubt, ideally, is accompanied by, it's a three-legged stool. Doubt, one leg. If you want details on this, you can read Hakuin, or you can read some of these Chinese teachers. Doubt, one leg. Faith, one leg. And determination, the other leg. Doubt, faith, and determination. Without one of those legs, the stool falls over, and you fall over. For example, if you just have faith and determination in some belief or some practice, you might become kind of rabid. You might become a Buddhist fundamentalist. You might become a proselytizer. You might go knocking on someone's door because you've got so much faith and determination, telling them that they should get with the program or whatever. Faith and determination without doubt create all kinds of problems. All kinds of problems. So years ago, when I was with my first teacher after I had settled on him, Shinryu Suzuki, I was having him and my second teacher, Katagiri Roshi, the founder of this Zen Center, over to dinner in San Francisco. I guess, oh, my friend Ruth was cooking, yeah. Some people from Nichiren Shoshu. Any of you know Nichiren Shoshu? Raise your hands if you know Nichiren Shoshu. One. Any others? Two. Rang the door, and I went down to talk to them. And they were like the equivalent of, for us in Christianity, Mormons or Seventh-day Adventists. They were saying, they noticed I was a meditator, and they said, you know, you don't have to do this meditation. All you have to do is recite the name of the Lotus Sutra, and if you just recite it, you can get enlightenment right like that, and you can get lots of stuff too. You can get the girlfriend you want, you can get a car, you can get all this stuff, And I don't know if they I don't think they knew Suzuki and Katagiri were upstairs having dinner with me. But I was trying to be polite with them. I told them I was having a group upstairs. Then I came upstairs and said, Suzuki asked, "Well, what was that?" I said, "Oh, it was some Nichiren Shoshu people trying to convert me and telling me I could get enlightened. I didn't have to sit on that zafu that you always are pushing on me." And he said, "Oh, I think they have a problem." Well, we have a problem when we get stuck on any belief. So that's why we need some doubt sometimes. We need some doubt. We always need some doubt. That's the third leg of the stool. It's important. It's important. And we have too much doubt, and we won't practice any meditation at all. We won't do any spirituality at all. So, again, my father, I came home and told him about Suzuki and about my quest and all this stuff. And he said, "Are you crazy?" He said, "You think you can tap into some deep stillness? That's just all made up stuff." That's all made up stuff. And I said, "Well, I'd like you to meet my teacher." He said, "Are you crazy? I don't want to meet a Buddhist." Buddhists are as bad as Catholics. Buddhists are as bad as Catholics. Then he married into my mother's family. Well, that's a whole other story, right? So he had so much doubt that he couldn't experiment with just being with himself, just breathing and being present and seeing if below the layers of all of this thought and worry there isn't some deep quietness. He didn't believe it. He said it couldn't be possible. It's impossible. And being my father's son, I was like him. Until I read this first book, which Wanda's heard me talk about lots of times, The Teachings of the Mystics by W.T. Stace. I was amazed to discover in Buddhism, in Vedanta, in Christianity, Meister Eckhart and St. John of the Cross and Teresa de Avila, in primal religion, that they all talked about tapping into some deep sense of camaraderie with all life, where our thinking mind just kind of slows down enough so we can feel great interconnection and wonder and joy. And so I didn't drop out of college, but I quit going to classes and I just read that book over and over again. And then I dropped out of college. so that was my inspiration. And each of us is here because we've had some inspiration, right? Some inspiration. It was my original one, and then I worked with my first teacher and my second teacher. And both of them said, everyone who practices with regularity and determination can tap into stillness. It's our birthright. It's our birthright. Even if you only tap into it for this long, for this breath, if you do it for this breath, that's good enough. This breath is good enough. So I had faith and I had determination, but I also had doubt because Suzuki kept telling me, and I say, "Well, I want to get enlightened. This is all about enlightenment." He said, "Well, you can't get enlightened. Enlightenment is not something you can get." And I said, "Well, but I want it." He said, "I'm sorry. Just sit on the cushion." Well, I had doubt. But that doubt propelled me to continue because I also had faith. Faith. Sometimes you get a little too much doubt and we just want to quit. Sometimes we get not enough doubt and we just want to proselytize, right? Just the right amount. Just the right amount. And we just have to feel our way along. We don't know what the right amount is. We feel our way along. Oh. So then there's something in Zen called the Great Doubt. And the Great Doubt is also universal. It's in the Vedas, Vedanta, it's in Sufi, it's really universal. And it's asking the question, the Great Doubt, if I'm not just my thinking, if I'm not just my worries and concerns, who am I? Who am I? Who are you? What is this Buddha nature? Is there really something or is it nothing? Who am I? The Great Doubt encourages us to do a retreat, to really go in, to really look, not just with our mind, but partly our mind, but also with our heart and our flesh and our bones and even our marrow, to look. What is this? Who am I? Am I an idiot, like my father said, to be getting me to do this practice? Am I a sinner, as my grandmother said, to keep doing this practice? Till I converted her. I actually converted her, but that's another story. I didn't try to convert her, but that's a whole other Dharma talk. Am I a great actor? I was a theater major in college. Oh, I'm not a great actor. But any thought we get attached to interrupts our deep questioning, going deep inside. Who has this thought? Who's the person who has this thought? Me? Who am I? Me? Who's me? This body and mind? What's this body and mind? What's this body and mind? Oh, it has two legs and a thinking mechanism. Who has two legs and a thinking mechanism? Who? This is the central koan. And all the koans in Zen come from this koan. This is the central koan. So, this is difficult, this who am I stuff, in a way. Although if you have feel an urgency about it, it's not as difficult as you think, because you keep with it. You keep with it. And you use your breath to go deeper. You use your breath to drill. Now, drill, that sounds kind of violent, but your breath is soft. Your breath, softly, you drill down through the layers of sediment, through the layers of concern, the layers of upsetness, the layers of despair. Your breath, you just drill through it. But it's a soft drill. It's your breathing naturally going all the way in, all the way down. Down to what? To who? Who's there? Asking. Do it in a relaxed way, as much as possible. Don't get mad at your wayward mind. Yeah, sure, your wandering mind's like a spoiled child that wants to run the show. I know that, because my mind's like that too. It's a spoiled child that wants to run the show, right? Pobrecita. Pobrecita. So, firm in our practice, firm in our breathing, without judgment, one breath and then another, one breath and another. Who's upset? Who's tired of this retreat? Oh, these people haven't been in the retreat. Oh, a couple of them have. Who is just exhausted from this retreat, wants to go right home? Who is it? Who is it? Who is glad they didn't sign up for this retreat at all? Who is it? Who is it? Who is angry? Who is depressed? Who is nervous? Who is struggling? Who is struggling? Is there someone struggling? Who's struggling? I'm struggling? You're struggling? Who is struggling? Who wants to tap into this deep wellspring that Tim supposedly tapped into himself? Who wants to do that? Who wants to do that? So here's a Zen story. A distraught man approached the teacher. "Please, teacher, I feel lost, desperate. I don't know who I am. Please show me my true self." The teacher just looked away without responding. The man began to plead and beg, but still the teacher gave no reply. Finally, giving up in frustration, the man turned to leave. At that moment, the teacher called out to him by name. "Yes," the man said as he spun back around. "There it is," exclaimed the teacher. "There it is." So self-images, we have lots of different self-images, don't we? There's the little Tim that got hurt when he was a little boy and still gets hurt. He's still here. Little Tim, the frightened Tim. Not frightened in front of you guys, but there are situations we could make him frightened. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are. There's the frightened Tim, not good enough Tim, the confident Tim who can teach the Dharma, right? And we feel and experience each of these as real at different times in our lives. And it's not that they're unreal, it's just that they're superficial and we get stuck on them and we need to go deeper by asking, who, what, questioning. These images are strong and component because of the feeling component. Because of the feeling component, the projections from our past, from things that happened to little Tim, are lodged in this body. They're lodged in this body. So they need to be paid attention to. But it's just a layer. We need to go deeper than that layer. We have the capacity to go deeper than that layer, than all those layers, than all those images, than all those selves. We all have the capacity. So whichever image is dominant right now is what you think me is, what you think you is, right? So a person I met with a few years ago, her parents constantly told her when growing up that she was a failure. And so her predominant self when she started coming to Zen Center was little me, useless me, no good me. Uh-huh. So first she had to see that. First she had to be open to that. She couldn't penetrate beyond it without taking care of it. But through her breathing practice and her steady meditation, she was able to go through that, move beyond her sense of a self that was inadequate. So we can let go of being hypnotized by these small selves. We can honor them. We can take care of them. Although, who takes care of them? Who honors them? Little Tim, needy Tim, jealous Tim. Ted's now the co-guiding teacher. You know, he really shouldn't be co-guiding teacher. He's okay, but I'm the man. Right? Jealous Tim, right? Right? None of these come up. They come up for all beings, all human beings. And all animal beings, too. There's been research done recently on animals and how animals have... We thought, animals only had all these primal emotions. They have all these emotions. Watch your dog get jealous when you start petting another dog. Right? So this is our wiring. This is part of being human. It's not something to diss. But we can go deeper. We can go deeper. We don't need to be hypnotized by the tyrannical self. The tyrannical self beats us, according to Western psychology, and I believe it a lot. Predominant selves for most human beings in this culture are the little child self who's wounded and not okay and feels like everybody is hurting. Feels hurt and other, it can't feels inadequate, and then the tyrannical self, which is the internal parent, that's saying, get your stuff together. Child, come on, quit doing this. Go in the closet for a while. Get yourself together. Do some meditation that really works. This meditation that you're doing doesn't work. Why don't you shape up and start doing more meditation every day? Do all the retreats. You know, and then the mediating self that's trying to mediate between the two, trying to mediate between the poor child and the inner tyrant. And Freud believed that all human beings could accomplish. Freud was basically a pessimist. All human beings would accomplish was the mediating self could successfully mediate between the internal tyrant and the internal child. But we know that those are just images. But they get lodged in us, those images. They get lodged in our bodies and our psyches. The mediator Tim. The calm Tim. Oh, and the entertaining Tim. People have been telling me my Dharma talks are entertaining. I never realized they were entertaining. Now I have a new image. Oh, I'm an entertainer. Wow. An entertainer. That's what teaching the Dharma is. It's entertaining. Woo! Who is that? Who is that guy? Can you make your body and mind a single mass of questioning? Who's the you who makes it a single mass of questioning? Can you really go into this? Really go into this? And you need the three, what are those things that a stool has? Three legs. Three legs of a stool. Faith, determination, and doubt. To do this practice. If you don't have enough faith, then probably you need to, listen to some Dharma talks or hang out with a teacher or mentor that you like. Or read some stuff. If you don't have enough doubt, just start questioning who it is that's doing this practice. Who it is that wants to be calm. Who it is that's so hurting. And this is how we become authentic. But authentic isn't some image. It's not an image. But it likes images. It includes images. It appreciates images. Sometimes it doesn't like images. It's authentic, right? It's authentic. It's not caught by any of the small selves. It sees when it's caught by them, but they don't dominate its life. So, Tom wants to discover his true self. He goes to the teacher. This is the same teacher as before, only now I've given him the name Tom. I could have given the name Tim, but whatever, or Deb. Deb wants to discover the true self. The teacher refuses to give any direction. Deb pleads and begs. Finally, giving up in frustration, Deb turns to leave. At that exact moment, the teacher calls out, Deb! Yes, Deb says. There it is, says the teacher. And Deb wakes up to who she really is, which is nobody in particular. Nobody in particular. It's just alive. Alive, not caught by all this stuff. Alive. More than those selves. Little Deb, bossy Deb. Mediating Deb, more than all those. So, that's what I want to say. And I'll be glad to entertain. Oh, yeah, I can do that. I was thinking I'm not supposed to during retreat, but I'm not following that rule anyway, so. You know, there are too many rules in Zen. I only like to follow about a quarter of them. So, questions, comments by anybody? Yeah, Maggie.
How would you define faith? Because because out of those three legs, that's the one I have a problem with. Raised Catholic and turned away from that. When I was seven, I figured out what they're telling me. People in a different part of the world are telling their seven-year-old kids. This is all made up stuff. It's all made up.
Yeah.
So the idea of faith to me is always kind of really negative.
Well, you know, you have to have faith to do anything. For instance, people who did this, who signed up for this retreat, had some faith that they wouldn't that their bodies and minds just wouldn't deteriorate and they wouldn't go crazy. They had to have faith that with a teacher and with a setup here and with everybody meditating together, that they'd be okay, and that maybe they'd tap into something deep. Maybe or maybe not. They had to have that faith. You had to have that faith that when you got here today, there'd be some, you'd feel good from the teaching or through hanging out with people, through sitting. So faith, yes, the faith that's a belief in something that's etched in stone is not the faith that we're talking about. But that's the faith that you experience. But that's why doubt is so important, because all of our beliefs are just beliefs. They're just images. So doubt is important. But without faith, we don't do anything. We just sort of give up. We just go into our hole.
So it's kind of just saying, I'll give it a chance.
Yeah, I'll give it a chance. I'll give life a chance. I'll give this thing that I really want to do a chance. Or this thing I partly want to do a chance. You know, no faith, and we've got terminal depression. Ugh, I mean, really. And people, lots of people have come here who've almost had terminal depression, meaning they're just so exhausted and hopeless about everything that they just, so they, you know, maybe by talking with me or Ted or sitting a little, they get a little faith that there's something they can do that can connect somehow. They can breathe for a few minutes, and in their breathing, let go of that heavy burden of their depression a little bit. Both of you guys.
Two comments. First, is another way of thinking about it trust?
Trust. People like trust better. Yeah, so maybe faith has too much baggage, those of you who are raised Christian. Yeah, so maybe trust. Well, let's try doing that. Faith, trust, doubt, and determination. Yeah, does that sound better? I don't know. Yeah.
The other comment was when you said one breath, you know, just enough.
Huh?
Just enough? One breath.
Yeah.
Just enough. And then there's the determination piece, which suggests that might not be enough. So how do you...
Well, I'm determined to take another breath. I'm determined to... Okay, I was talking to folks in the retreat. I was saying, you know, you have an aspiration for enlightenment, and then you get in a huge funk. You just want to leave the retreat. So I said, okay, for the next 5 minutes, just do two breaths. Have faith that you can do two breaths. And then after 5 minutes... have faith that you can do three breaths and see what happens. See what happens. Yeah. Yeah, Wanda.
I just like to share one of my favorite sayings that Buddha had for trust. The Hindu word for trust is shraddha.
Yeah.
And Buddha said that shraddha is the trust that a bird has in the tree in which she builds her nest.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah, yeah. Good.
Without it, you can't do anything.
Yeah. Benton. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Thank you, Wanda. Yeah.
So my friends and I have talked a little bit.
Can you speak a little louder? Because I'm hard of hearing.
So my friend said I could be quite a chameleon. Like, I just adapt really well to different people, different scenarios.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like my different selves, when you say the authentic self, I sometimes don't know what that exactly means, because I'm just like, always adapting to like whatever people I'm around, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'm like completely like, what is my authentic self anymore?
So is that a pattern that you know about for years? What's your name?
Jimmy.
Jimmy, is that something you've just noticed recently?
I've just been called called out recently on it.
Oh. And when you do that adaption, how are you feeling inside? Have you checked that out? Are you feeling like you're just being accommodating to get along?
Yeah, just to get buy-in, to make people feel like...
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a possible sign of a little bit of entanglement, a little bit of an enmeshment, which I've been talking about also, from your childhood, so that you feel like you have to be nice to people to get along. You have to give in to them, get along. It could be a sign of that. So it's something to pay attention to. I don't know. I can't tell from that much for sure, but it's something to pay attention to. And you know, getting in touch with what you most deeply care about. What you most deeply want. And not dissing other people, because adaptability is wonderful. We have to be able to adapt. But we also need to be authentic. So how's that? Uh-huh. Can you adapt to what I said?
This is years back, said I was like silly putty, which seems even like maybe even worse. I knew exactly what he was talking about. I didn't feel disrespectful. Like, yeah, that's the way I got along with people.
Yeah.
So, fine. Yeah. But it kind of felt like, yeah, that's kind of how I interact and get along with people is looking at how they're responding, and
yeah,
I was like silly putty.
It's survival. It's how we survive. We need to survive. Life is hard, and as kids, we don't know. We just do whatever the environment tells us. Our environment. A lot of kids got caught by the environment. That's how you survive.
You might not know what silly putty is.
Well, what did you say, Deb?
You might not know what silly putty is. But you put it against something, it picks up the pattern of whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Image.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Oh, good.
Anybody else this morning? Yeah.
What was the name of that book you said earlier?
Oh, well, I don't even know if that book's in print anymore. It's called The Teachings of the Mystics by W.T. Stace, S-T-A-C-E. Yeah.
Do you know if we have that in the library?
Pardon? I have no idea.
If it's been influencing to you, we should have it in life.
Yeah, well, I tried to taping it together over the years, and it's gone now. Yeah.
I'm from Taiwan. My family is a Buddhism family. I just grew up like this environment. I never doubted there's a Buddha or there's many, many Buddhas. But I want to ask you one question. When you face,
you're going to have to speak loud.
When you face a disaster, like a sudden death, will you figure out, you know, will you doubt there's a real Buddha? Because like my older brother, he passed away suddenly, just at a very young age.
Can someone help me? I didn't get the question. Let's have someone help me. Will one of you guys paraphrase what she said?
When you face death.
Pardon?
If someone in your life died suddenly.
Yes.
Would that cause you to doubt the...
The things you believe, like, you know, there's Buddha or...
Well, everybody's dying all the time, but if someone that I love dies... suddenly, I'll be sad. I'll be just maybe distraught, but it's all this interdependent flow of life. So, I'll right in the middle of it. I'll be sad and distraught, but I won't lose a sense of connection to all life. My connection to all life includes my connection to all death. So why would I lose it? I can't lose it. It's here at the bedrock. It doesn't mean I'm not sad. I don't cry buckets. But I don't lose it. But do I have faith? I have faith. But if the faith is in something and that that person's going to a better world or a worse world, then that faith will be just a two-legged stool and I'll fall over. And having some doubt is good too, even then, because I don't know what happens when they go. I know Buddhists think they know, Christians think they know, Muslims think they know. Really? 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 Look into that. Doubt that. Doubt that. Shamans think they know. Really? Really? Shamans say, I used to do shamanic practice too. You go into the spirit world. Oh, okay. All right. Really? Maybe. Maybe. Heaven? Maybe. Hell? Maybe. Pure land? Maybe. Reincarnation? Maybe. Maybe reborn as a cup? Well, this is my... Maybe you get to be reborn as a cup you want to? I want to be reborn as this cup. Or, you know, so... Faith and doubt. I don't know. But I have faith in just this life, which includes death, because... Well, everything's dying always. Everything we planned and cared about is going away. I don't know. Does that answer your question? Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I don't know. Do we have time for another question, Deb? I can't remember what the deal is here. We have time for one more. Okay.
Not necessarily a question, but in lieu of the idea of faith... I oftentimes ask myself why I feel the need to meditate every day.
Uh-huh.
I feel the need to come to these sessions. And I felt if someone were to ask me that, I wouldn't really know the answer why.
Okay.
Which is funny in a way. But when I consider meditation and my past experience with it, I find that it helps me accidentally stumble into answers that I didn't really know was a question in the first place in regards to finding out my authentic self.
Good. Excellent. Excellent. So, you know, my teacher's statement, not my teacher's statement. I thought it was my teacher's, but someone else corrected me. Some teacher's statement, when asked about enlightenment, that was Robert Aiken, asked about enlightenment. He said, enlightenment is an accident, but through our practice, we're making ourselves accident prone.